Before we begin today's episode, I wanted to let you know that we will be hearing about historical abuses against Indigenous people, some of these stories reference beatings and murders. Take care as you listen.
A gente tem que ficar muito forte para.
I have to stay strong to be able to sing.
This is the voice of Antonia Carvalho. But in this episode, we're going to call him Wera Guarari, his Indigenous Guaranese name, what he calls his birth name. In the summer of 2023, Wera flew to the UK to take part in protests at BHP's London offices. We met with him during this time, and he asked if he could share a traditional Guaranese chant with us about his people's rivers and forests. It was painful for him to sing it. He told us that the chant reminds him that the river given to his people by the gods is no longer there. He took a moment and began to sing again. I'm Liz Bonin, and this is Dead River, Episode 6, A Silent War. At the very beginning of this podcast series, I told you a story about a Brazilian gold mine that was closed off by a rockslide in 1844. The people who worked in that Casa Branca gold mine in the state of Minas Gerais were all enslaved people trafficked from Africa. When the rockslide prevented them from escaping, the owners flooded the mine with water, drowning everyone trapped inside. The mistreatment and killing of enslaved people during this period was far too common an occurrence. The first vessels carrying enslaved people arrived from Africa in the mid-1500s, and by the time Brazil abolished slavery in 1888, around 5.5 million people had been trafficked and forced to work as slaves, more than any other country in the world. But Africans were not the first to be enslaved in Brazil. Others had been forced out of their homes and into slave labor before this.
Eu sou Michael Krenak. Sou dos caciques.
I'm Michael Krenak. I'm one of the Krenak leaders and a leader in our territory in Resplendor, which is located on the border between Minas Gerais and Espírito Santo State.
Over the course of making this podcast, the production team had the great privilege to meet with members of the indigenous Krenak community, who told us what their land means to them.
This is the land of our ancestors, our land. It gives us everything we need. It has our forests and our rivers, and it brings us health. It brings us peace. It's where we get our livelihood from. And for us, our land is not just the land. It's the father. It's the mother. It's what gives us our reason for being.
The Krenak are descendants of the Botu Kodu community, who are considered to be the first human inhabitants of the Doce River Valley and who lived in this region of Brazil until the late 18th century. Today, the Krenak people's home is still on the banks of the river in the town of Resplendor.
É impossível definir Krenak sem relacionar o Rio Doce, porque são os Burunduatu.
It is impossible to define the Krenaks without referring to River Doce, because we are the river people.
The first recorded contact between the Krenak's ancestors and colonial settlers took place in the 16th century.
I'm Dr. Andresa Rusco de Souza Santos. I'm the director of the King's Brazil Institute. I work on company towns in Brazil, especially on mining companies and towns that are incredibly dependent on mining. The history of mining, the more, official records of mining in the region, it dates back to the Bandeirantes, the Brazilian, also called Paulistas, who explored the hinterlands of Brazil. Mining, they are also famous for also enslaving indigenous groups for mining.
Bandeirantes, thought of by some as great explorers and by others as great exploiters, were groups of men from the southern regions of Brazil who are largely credited with expanding the country of Brazil to the size it is today. In the late 15th century, the first colonial settlements in what we now call Brazil were mainly coastal villages revolving around small plantations. As the colonies grew, so did the demand for more labour. So the Bandeirantes set their sights inland and, loaded with firearms, began their expeditions to capture indigenous people into enslavement. Some of the first tracks and routes carved into Brazil's dense inland rainforest were created to support these missions. Indigenous communities were captured using the element of surprise and force. The Bandeirantes would target a village, surround it, use firepower and aggression to subdue the people, pillage their belongings, and destroy or set alight whatever remained. Records show that these expeditions continued for hundreds of years. By the 1700s, an abundance of gold was found in the state of Minas Gerais, and the Bandeirantes turned their attention to this region. It was during this time that the first mass extermination of the Botu Kodu people, the Krenak's ancestors, was attempted. Their cruel and violent efforts lasted for decades through mass shootings and horrific brutality. At the end of this period of unspeakable atrocities, the last remaining Botu Kodu escaped into the dense forests along the banks of the River Doce. It's estimated that by then, only 14,000 of them had survived. The River Doce and its surrounding forests provided some safety for the Botu Kodu. But at the end of the 18th century, many of the mines in Minas Gerais had been entirely stripped of their gold, and mining operators wanted to explore new regions. Fearing that the Botu Kodu community would fight back against their expansion efforts, in 1808, the King of Portugal signed a document that would become known as the War of Extermination against the Botu Kodus of the River Doce. This extermination was carried out partly through horrendous physiological warfare. Smallpox was introduced to the communities through gifts and contaminated food left in the forest. By 1884, it was estimated that only 5,000 Botu Kodu people remained. And from these survivors came their descendants, the Krenak.
Que desde que o povo Krenak entende por...
There has always been a fight between the Krenaks and the mining company, for as long as we can remember. They invaded our lands to set up mines, and they laid down train tracks to transport their mined minerals across the country. The construction of that train line killed so many indigenous people. To build their mines and the train lines connecting them, they also had to deforest large areas of the Doce Valley rainforest. And then, at one point, the mining companies also belonged to the Brazilian government.
What Ludmila Krenak is referring to here is the creation of the company Vale. Vale was originally founded under the name the Vale Company of River Doce, and it was established in Itabira, Minas Gerais, by the Brazilian federal government on the 1st of June 1942. By 1974, Vale was the world's biggest exporter of iron ore. What's significant about this period of prosperity for Vale is that it was also at the height of the Brazilian military dictatorship.
So we've always been fighting, not only the mining companies, but also the government.
The voice of Anderson de Souza, a leader in the Krenak community.
During the dictatorship, we were taken from our lands and put into other villages with different indigenous people.
During this time, Krenak people were imprisoned in what the government called reformatories. They were tortured and forced to work as slaves. This brutal and inhumane treatment was justified by the military, who said that the indigenous people refused to reform and act like, quote, civilized Brazilians. The dictatorship lasted from 1964 to 1985, and during this time, the government also wanted to expand mineral exports and agribusiness, and they saw indigenous groups as an obstacle to that mission.
Our people have always suffered. We have never had any support from any governments or from any organizations or institutions. We have always fought loudly to be heard. But there are a lot of things we have had to do in silence. We had to silently accept the loss of loved ones, of children and parents and grandparents. During the dictatorship, our people were persecuted, killed, arrested, and every effort was made to silence us. For hundreds of years, we have suffered massacres, and people have consistently tried to silence us.
Durante a ditadura militar no Brasil,
during the dictatorship, we were even forbidden from speaking our traditional language. We all had to learn to speak Portuguese. This was just another way that we were abused and silenced.
Towards the end of the military dictatorship, the Krenak people, along with other imprisoned indigenous groups, were forcibly removed from their land in Resplendor and relocated to camps near Governador Valadares until the regime ended. The dictatorship ended in 1985, but by this point there were very few Krenak left. It's estimated that at that time, only 60 members of the Krenak community remained on the banks of the River Doce. 26 of the last of the Krenak people travelled back to their ancestral land in Resplendor. By this point, the land was owned by the government and leased by farmers. But despite pressures and forcible tactics used by the leasers of the land, the Krenak stood firm in their resolve to reclaim ownership of their territory. In 1997, the Federal Supreme Court annulled the land titles given to the farmers and gave 4,000 hectares of land back to the Krenak.
Where we lived, for me, it was...
it was the best place to live. It was very calm, very tranquil, and very healthy. It was my land, and I loved it deeply.
Over the next 18 years, the community came together to try to heal from centuries of abuse, genocide, and eradication of their culture. They returned to their way of life as best they could, fishing for their food, blessing their children in the river, and teaching them to swim. They rekindled traditional rituals and celebrations, and they added to their families and to their community. Their village became a welcoming place again for neighboring communities.
Ele não só é ali brincavam o povo Krenak.
We would host our traditional games, and it wasn't just for the Krenak people, you know. We held a game ceremony for other indigenous people to participate in. And it was the first time that had happened in Minas Gerais. All the indigenous people from along the river came to play in the games there.
In November 2015, he saw footage of a dam collapsing upriver near the city of Mariana.
Então, a gente viu, eu particularmente vi no noticiário.
I saw the dam collapse on the news. And at the time, I couldn't really believe it. I was really shocked to see what had happened. And a lot of people came to me and asked, do you think it's going to reach us? And I said, no. No, it's not going to come here. At the time, I was just so upset with the level of destruction that I saw. But I didn't think it was going to affect us.
But within a week, the mining waste from the Fundão Dam had flowed into the Doce River and was beginning to wash up on the banks of the Krenak village of Resplendor.
E esse momento de despedida aí,
At that moment, we went to say goodbye. It was extremely sad because our elders came to the river and they kept saying,
que, né, o rio morreu, né, o rio tá morto.
The river has died. The river is dead. All around me, people were asking, what are we going to do now? The river was all we had to sustain ourselves physically, but also spiritually. And no one knew what the future looked like. The river was our spiritual home. And we knew there was nothing we could do to save it. And we were just thinking, how are things going to be?
The history of the Krenak people and their ancestors is tainted and smeared by the story of mining in Brazil. In the name of extracting minerals, they were tortured and enslaved. They were massacred. They were forced off their land over and over again. They were imprisoned and stripped of their culture and language. After centuries of abuse, they had finally returned home to the river they had always fought to protect, only for it to be destroyed, taken away from them again by mining companies. And this time, no one knows if they can ever get it back.
Então, né, até hoje a gente quando pensa ou passa perto do rio,
and now, when we walk past or when we go close to the river, we feel a profound sadness because we lost everything. And now we don't really know what the future will hold for us. We don't really know how we can move forward with such a tremendous loss. From the very day the mining mud arrived, we stopped having a relationship with the river. And now, we're even afraid to put our foot in the river because it's so contaminated. We know that now, the river is dead.
Following the dam collapse, the Krenak stopped fishing in the river, a practice that had sustained them for hundreds of years. They planted crops like rice, cassava, and beans to live off instead. But without safe water to irrigate them, the crops shriveled and died in the heat. For days after the contaminated water reached them, the Cranach were ignored by the mining companies, receiving no support or drinking water. On November 13th, they decided to occupy a stretch of the Victoria Mina Railroad, built by Vale, in protest against the conditions in which they were forced to live. After 3 days of protesting, Vale pledged emergency support, stating that they would, quote, supply water for human and animal consumption, food supplementation for animals, financial support for indigenous communities, allocation of resources for health actions, and the allocation of 2 small boats. But the Cranach felt that this support plan didn't take into consideration their needs or way of life as indigenous people. For example, each family received 6 heads of cattle and animal feed from the Renova Foundation.
But livestock is not part of our culture. So many families sold the cows or ate them shortly after we received them. It's just a tragedy what's happening to the Cranach. Our elders are dying of sorrow. In 5 years, 10 years' time, a Cranach boy won't have his culture because he's not learning to fish or to hunt or to sustain himself.
We asked the Renova Foundation and BHP for comment and they have not responded. We asked Vale for comment and they responded with the following.
Vale clarifies that its relationship with the Cranach people predates the failure of the Fundão Dam, including its support for productive, cultural and environmental activities. In 2023, the company renewed a long-term agreement with the community to contribute to its ethno-development. Vale deeply regrets what happened in Mariana and has been in constant dialogue with the Cranach people to make emergency support possible, including the supply of drinking water. Following the disaster, the railroad was blocked by some members of the Cranach people in Resplendor, Minas Gerais, disrupting not only cargo and passenger operations, but also preventing the delivery of water to communities in the Doce River region, including the indigenous people in question. The reparation process is being carried out by the Renova Foundation in accordance with the Settlement and Conduct Adjustment Agreement signed with the Brazilian Justice Authorities. The actions taken to compensate the community include monthly payments of emergency subsistence aid, the supply of mineral water, drinking water and raw water, food deliveries and social and environmental strengthening initiatives. In addition, numerous measures have been taken to restore the springs in the indigenous land and periodic maintenance and improvement work is carried out on roads and access tracks.
We spoke to some members of the Cranach community in London in 2023. They were here as part of the legal case the law firm Pogus Goodhead had brought against BHP. The Cranach have been a warrior people for hundreds of years. Historically, when they prepared for war, they painted their bodies and faces with broad strokes of red and intricate black geometric designs. They wore ornate headdresses and bands on their arms and legs adorned with feathers of all colours of the rainbow. When we met them, they were dressed in this way. When asked what the significance of it was, they said, quote, "This is how we dress when we're going into battle. And right now, we are in battle."
É tudo, né? Todos nós somos mais fortes juntos, tanto os povos tradicionais.
We know we have to be strong. We know that we have to work together, not just with other indigenous communities, but with all of mankind. We all need to fight for the greater good. We need to fight for our water, fight for our land, for our environment, for our Mother Nature.
Unlike battles of the past, this isn't a war that can be fought with weapons or with force. This is what the Cranach referred to in 2022 as, quote, a silent war, one that in many ways the Krenak feel they have already lost. They know the mining companies can't give them back their river, but now they're fighting for the justice that can be won.
In terms of reparation, in terms of justice, no money is going to pay for what we have lost. It can help to offset some of the damage that these companies have caused. But our dignity, our way of life, we're not going to recover that. And justice would mean that people were held accountable and found guilty for what had happened. Because if nobody's penalized, nothing happens. If there's no justice, other rivers will die, other people will die, and the entire mankind, the entire humanity will die. We will all end up like that river.
At the time of this podcast recording, no justice has been served in Brazil. A case was filed in 2016 by the Brazilian Federal Prosecution that charged people associated with the mining companies with qualified homicide and environmental crimes. In 2019, all charges of homicide were dropped, but the case remained active. In November of 2023, 7 years after the case was raised, BHP's Vice President for Legal Affairs for the Americas said they were hopeful about reaching a deal by the end of the year. As of January 2024, the federal government of Brazil have now suspended talks with the mining companies, and they've said, quote,
"As of January 2024, the federal government of Brazil have now suspended talks, saying that these companies do not demonstrate social and environmental responsibility and commitment to the reparation process. And, unfortunately, the companies have been unwilling to make effective reparations for a tragedy that is now 8 years old, has claimed the lives of 19 people, and has left deep socio-environmental and economic damage beyond the region directly affected, impacting the states of Minas Gerais, Espírito Santo, and the country. However, none of these amounts will go towards compensating any individuals affected by the disaster, something which the case in the UK seeks to address."
When the bandeirantes of the 18th century were prospecting for minerals in the state of Minas Gerais, they established the town of Bento Rodrigues. The town gets its name from one of the so-called explorers that claimed this land. Enslaved Africans worked in the gold mines near the town, and many of them lived in Bento Rodrigues with their families. Mauro da Silva was a resident of Bento Rodrigues in 2015. He is a descendant of one of these families.
Bento Rodrigues nasceu da mineração.
Bento Rodrigues is the name of one of the pioneers that explored the region in the 18th century. And in 1710, Bento himself founded the city because there was gold mining activity. And my family, we were slaves. So my ancestors, all of my ancestors, were slaves, and they worked in the gold mines.
Here's journalist Cristina Serra.
You have some families there in Bento Rodrigues that the story of that families goes back to the times of slavery here in Brazil. So this is a historic site. This is the story of Brazil.
Mining was intertwined into the very fabric of how life was for slaves in this town. And it's a legacy that is still strongly felt by people like Mauro to this day.
Escravizados para o trabalho.
I can't help but to discern mining from its historical ties to slavery. Mining, for me, points towards structural racism. It's an exploitation of the land, of the people. It used to be then, and it still remains now. Now, this exploitation expresses itself in the way in which crumbs are given to people in order to allow the companies to continue to pursue wealth while exploiting the land. You see that crumbs are given in the form of minor benefits, minor salaries, constructions in various communities, but it all amounts to something very hollow.
What Mauro says rings true for generations of families born and raised in and around Bento Rodriguez.
The legacies of slavery, the burden of the past is extremely present in everyday life.
That's Dr. Andresa Santos. She says one of the ways this legacy persists today is in a relationship of dependency between residents of mining towns and the mining companies.
It's a very ambiguous relationship because the relationship of dependency as a relationship of intimidation, fear to be perceived as a problem by the company, a company that is so profitable, but it's a relationship of also a resentment and fear, right, of what am I going to lose? So a company that works so close to their homes, that creates a lot of noise pollution, that creates a lot of environmental losses, that sometimes prevent people from have access to a cemetery or some other place of leisure because they will mine too close to those areas. And people resent the companies for that. They resent the companies for not hiring them. At the same time that there is a lot of resentment, and especially when there are disasters and very direct losses and loss of life, there is this fear of confronting.
Bento Rodriguez is the perfect example of what Dr. Santos is describing. Many generations of residents there worked for the mining companies. They dealt with explosions and earthquakes caused by the mines and put up with noisy trucks kicking up dust daily. In return, they had jobs and some financial security. But the fear of confrontation and asking for better conditions kept the mining companies in a position of power. This dynamic became even more apparent once the dam collapsed, as Dr. Santos explains.
It is a very symmetric relationship of legally sophisticated actors with a lot of economic power versus highly dependent residents, which don't have the same level of legal sophistication or information even about what is happening. So even in negotiations, when you try to negotiate for compensations, it's extremely hard to think how far you can push if you don't know what numbers of profits are. So here I am negotiating for compensation. What is a meaningful compensation for a community that has so much to lose? And especially if you don't know what is the profit being made. So you push for what? What are the limits? What is possible? So how do you enter a negotiation room without the information like that?
The history of this unequal relationship in Bento Rodriguez rests heavily on the shoulders of residents, and it can leave them feeling powerless. Back in 2017, journalist Cristina Serra visited Bento Rodriguez while writing her book, The Tragedy of Mariana. When she returned in 2023, 8 years after the disaster, what she saw was, once again, testament to the imbalance of power.
I was very sad when I went there because the ruins, the old houses, what was left of old Bento Rodriguez, some walls that are still there. Almost everything is being covered by bushes. There are bushes everywhere. And another thing is that Samarco built two small dams to contain water. And so part of the old Bento Rodriguez is underwater. Marquinhos Muniz, one of our interviews, he showed us where his house was located. And nowadays, the place where his house was is completely underwater.
The town, built by mining prospectors in 1710, now lies destroyed and half submerged because of modern-day mining companies. And even to this day, residents say that what remains of the town is being held hostage by these same mining companies. Even after robbing people of their homes, livelihoods, and land, their position of power is allowing them to do what they please with what has been left behind. But a group of ex-residents, including Mauro da Silva, aren't giving up on their town that easily. They call themselves Crazy for Bento, and they return to the site of their former homes every weekend.
They go there to just to meet and to talk about their former life there. They go there to their religious festivities to keep their traditions alive. And they say it's a way to occupy the land and say to San Marco, this land is ours and you are not going to take this land from us. I feel when I talk to these people, they care for their story. We are here. We are not invisible. The company will not erase our history and our memories.
The harsh reality of mining towns is that they were built to support the mining industry and therefore are dependent on mining. And Bento Rodriguez was no exception. But here's where it gets even more perplexing. Since the disaster, the complex ties between miners and the mining industry have still not been disentangled. You might be feeling angry after listening to this story. You might be wishing that the mining companies would just pack up their equipment and leave. You could be thinking that surely, after centuries of tearing the earth apart, displacing the people of this land, and being responsible for the worst environmental disaster in the country, the best thing for them to do is right their wrongs and leave, never to return. And for many people in Brazil, this really is what they are hoping for. But it's also not that simple. There are people in Bento Rodriguez who worked for Samarco when the dam collapsed and who still work for them now. And there are others who started working for Samarco after the dam collapse because they lost their original source of income as a result of all the damage and destruction. These communities rely so heavily on the mining industry here that when Samarco was forced to stop operating after the disaster, people in neighboring towns to Bento Rodriguez blamed the victims of the collapse for the loss of their livelihoods.
I guess at first they had a lot of solidarity, but then when the companies were banned from being in the area, then a lot of people started losing their jobs, and the community turned against the victims as if they cannot do that to the city, they cannot displace an entire city, they cannot make everybody lose their jobs. So they lost a lot of friends and solidarity, and there was protest for the companies to come back. The victims, they were perceived as an obstacle for the comeback of the companies.
On top of still relying on the mining companies for livelihoods, the disaster has created more situations that make communities utterly dependent on them. For example, it's the mining companies that some affected towns still rely on for clean water. Dr. Andreza believes this type of dependency and inequity has to stop. She wants companies to consider their legacy in the communities they operate in.
What is my legacy? When I go, what people will think of the time where I stayed here? While the companies are there and while they're profitable, which investment can they make to leave a positive legacy afterwards? What can be the use of the buildings for society during the time that they're there and afterwards? what is the relationship that they can have with the community that can also develop the area around them? Which positive legacy can they have? How can they plan for their departure in a very positive way for their community? I think there is potential to improve their relationship. And of course, they need more pressure from civil society. The pressure, as we have seen, is potentially not coming so strong locally, because locally there is a strong dependency on the company. So the communities and the government, they are taking these scraps. They are just taking whatever the company can offer. But I believe that there needs to be more pressure, more examples coming and being shared of good practices that leave a positive legacy.
In England, Pogust Goodhead is also working to apply this pressure and create lasting change. As a law firm, they may not have the power to completely dismantle the systemic issues in Brazil between local and indigenous communities and mining companies, but they do have the power of the law to hold polluters to account while leveraging something that these large multinational companies understand. Money. Their goal is not only to hold BHP accountable for the destruction they caused in Brazil, but to send a clear message to other companies too. There will be consequences for your actions, and they will cost you.
Litigation finance and class action had a, I wouldn't say a bad reputation, but it wasn't the best reputation either. As if we were commercializing the judicial system. This is something that I heard once. And this is so sad to hear that. I'm sad is the word, because this rhetoric supports the powerful to remain negligent and non-compliant.
That's Ana Carolina Salamão, the chief financial officer at Pogust Goodhead. One of her jobs is to source funding for the BHP case. Amongst other things, these investments provide victims with free legal representation. Ana is a descendant of Indigenous peoples, and so this issue is especially close to her heart.
If parties do not have the means to stand up for their rights and access just through courts, those corporations won't have an incentive to change their practice. The world has changed. This is all in motion now. This is another mechanism that we have to rebalance things and to prevent total collapse of the planet. Readjusting corporate conduct by their own means. So meaning, if it is a financial decision, let's make this financial decision more costly. If it is a financial decision to not interrupt work on a dam or to not reinforce a dam, and to keep operations because any financial reasoning, well, so let's make it more costly. If they are going to take this all as financial decision, litigation finance has the power to make more costly the decision of ignoring citizens.
I think the story of this disaster tells us about the story of Brazil, and we have to reflect about this. That's why it's so important to have justice. And it's very symbolic that the case against BHP is going to happen in England, the place who got some of our gold. You know, it's like history making us reflect about all this colonial system.
The collapse of the Fundão Dam didn't happen in a vacuum. It's the result of centuries of colonial and capitalist history, ultimately culminating in what took place that fateful day. Recognizing the legacy of such a troubled past helps us to understand why the mining companies were able to continue operating a dam that showed signs of leaks for years without consequence. It gives us more empathy for the residents of Bento Rodrigues, who chose to trust that the dam built above their town was safe. It allows us to deeply feel the anger and sadness the Krenak feel about losing their kin, a river they fought for hundreds of years to protect. And it gives us more insights into why, even after a disaster of this scale that killed 19 people, left hundreds homeless, thousands without water, and millions worried about the safety of the Dose, these mining companies still operate today. It's now been over 8 years since the Fundao Dam collapsed. Every victim you heard from in this podcast is still living with the trauma and dealing with the impact of this disaster every single day. Some people, like the Krenak, still don't have direct access to drinking water. Some, like Bahalonga resident Laura Freitas, still don't have a permanent home. Others, like Ana Paula, are still waiting for an individual compensation order to be set by the Brazilian government. And some, like Pamela, are just trying to get through each day while the loss of their loved one weighs heavily on their heart. And yet, amidst unfathomable grief and upheaval, the people of Minas Gerais and Espírito Santo are using their pain to help their communities.
This is the main thing that I saw. People that are still suffering so much. But at the same time, you see people strong enough to go ahead, despite all the difficulties and despite all the injustice we see in this case.
One of the people looking to the future is Romeo Anjos, the only Samarco employee who was caught in the mud but survived.
Romeo is still suffering so much with the consequences, the emotional consequences of the disaster. But at the same time, he is nowadays one of the directors of the union workers of Mariana. And this process, I felt this process empowered him. And it's a way for him to help other workers with the demands the workers have toward the mining industry. It's a difficult process to him, but he found a way to go ahead with his life. In the other hand, you have people like Paula Geralda Alves, and she was the one who, when she saw the mud coming, she took her motorcycle and she ran to Bento Rodrigues to warn people that the mud is coming. So she saved many lives. Samarco didn't have a siren to warn people about an emergency. So Paulo Alves was that human siren. And she is looking ahead for her future. She is working as a judicial assistant of a lawyer that is helping other victims to try to search for their rights. So Paula is an incredible person. She helped people that day, going to the village and warning them about the mud that's coming. And nowadays, she is still trying to help people to have their rights. It's very inspirational to see a person like her.
Now you know the story of the Mariana Dam collapse, Brazil's worst environmental disaster. You know about the people affected, the companies involved, and that once upon a time, the Dose River coursed to the sea for over 800 kilometers, clean, pure, and strong, the lifeblood of everything and everyone around it. In October of 2024, hundreds of thousands of victims may finally have their day in court. As for the Dead River, only time will tell.
I have hope that one day we will have some justice for this case. I still think that one day I will come back to Mariana and I will see people somehow satisfied with their compensations. Or because of the result of the case in England, I have to believe that we will have an answer for that situation. I really think that one day I could come back here in Mariana, and I really want to ask them, now, how do you feel? Do you think you have justice at last? And I really hope that they can say to me, yes, now I'm happy.
Dead River is narrated by me, Liz Bonin, and investigated by journalist Christina Serra and Pulama Kaufman. The podcast is produced by Pulama Kaufman. Stories are meant to be shared, so if, like us, you think this is a powerful and important story, please let your friends and family know about Dead River. And if you're enjoying this series, please leave a rating and review. Thanks for listening.